Shalom everyone, Erev Tov. I've decided to give this topic of a shir, and I have to tell you that I've never given this specific type of shir in my life. It's actually a collection of thoughts that I've had the past few weeks. And I'll explain to you where I'm coming from and what brought me to think about dedicating a shir that is really about the war, the current war in Israel, from the perspective of getting married. L'tzareinu harav, unfortunately, in the past 75 years here in Israel, there have been many, many situations in which questions came up during war, and the rabbis have been challenged by these questions. And unfortunately, as I said, many of these questions have repeated themselves throughout the wars. And the famous questions that are mentioned every few years from 48 and during the Six-Day War, the 73 War, Yom Kippur War, these questions somehow changed, but they were all begadol the same. I'll give you a few examples that of questions that repeat themselves. Almost every war is a question about whether or not a chayal tzahal is allowed to eat non-kosher food in a war situation, due to the fact that the Rambam writes down in the Book of Law of Hilchot Melachim that there's a special halacha that during war you don't have to eat kosher. The special idea, this is a shir of itself, not for now, but that's a famous question. Another question is that comes up are, again, this is not a question that necessarily refers to the Israeli army today, because due to legal matters that we are a country with a Western, you know, kind of democratic laws. But in the biblical times, what was the Torah's approach to taking shalal, to taking bounty during war? What does halacha say about that? Are you allowed to take spoils of war? That's a famous question that actually did come up during the different wars. Fighting on Shabbat, and what that includes, what that heter includes, if it's bringing bodies to burial, etc., on Shabbat and Yom Tov, are famous questions that came up during the Yom Kippur War and even before that. So there are many, many questions. However, this war that started on Simchat Torah, and we don't even have an official name for this war yet, this war, I think, highlighted in a terrible way specific questions that have repeated themselves so many times. I think there are questions that almost are more than technicalities. They're more than technical questions. They are questions that talk about the essence of what's happening here. And I chose in today's year and next year two questions that have come up that might sound at first glance as, you know, interesting halachic questions, but I would like to explain tonight why they are not just small technical questions, but rather they hide within them, I would say, a big piece of what we are all going through here in Israel and the Chutz Laaretz during these really challenging times. The question which I'm focusing on, is it halachically permitted to get married during war? Now, the truth is, my question is a very difficult question, because I mentioned the word halachically, and I have to tell you from the beginning that there's no real halacha regarding the question. I'm not aware of any clear halachic source that even discusses such a question. I will suggest possible sources that discuss this, but to my knowledge, there is no real halachic question per se regarding this matter. But the question was asked many times. I can tell you, I'm not a big posek. I don't get many questions, but I get my share of questions, and I share them many times with my students, and I show them many times that I would say the majority of questions that I'm asked personally are not necessarily halachic questions. People ask me questions that they have a feeling that something is wrong or right, and it has to do with something Jewish, religious, tradition, but it's not necessarily a halachic question. And I think the same would be in this case. And I'll tell you why I chose this question. Because if you remember, in the beginning of the war, there were a lot of couples that were supposed to get married after Sukkot, in the early winter, and still in Israel a bit, the weather is still good, and many of the chayalim were obviously drafted to the Israeli army, and the question came up whether or not they should postpone the wedding or not. Now, you know, you can say, well, if there's no chayal, it's a little bit hard to have a wedding because he's in the battlefield. But if you remember again, the first few weeks of the war, we didn't go straight into Gaza. The chayalim were really scattered in different places waiting to go in. And there was the possibility of performing weddings on the army bases. And if you remember, there became a whole new trend at the time, chayalim and chayalot, which is also unique for this war. We've never had so many women in the Israeli army. Chayalim and chayalot were getting married on army bases, which I think some parents were very happy. They saved like $50,000 that way, because, you know, open up a can of tuna fish on an Israeli base and make a wedding, saved a bit of money. But seriously speaking, it became a trend. And there were YouTube videos and Facebook, and it was on social media, and I'm sure people remember what I'm talking about, that you saw all these weddings happening. Now, I remember a story that during the Yom Kippur War, there was a gentleman from Alon Shvuta and his wife Amos, and I'll say the name Amos and Sarah Safrai from Alon Shvuta. Amos learned in Gush and during the Yom Kippur War, and they were supposed to get married within the week after Simchat Torah, and I heard the story was, and it was even printed somewhere, that the Kala, you know, there was no phones there, and she didn't know what was going on, so she showed up to the wedding hall with her wedding dress, not sure, not knowing if her husband would show up, and he of course didn't show up, he was in the battlefield, and then during the war somehow he got out for a few days or something like that. And they went to consult Rav Amital, the Rosh Shiva of Gush. And they consulted him whether or not they should go ahead with the wedding. And the question really was, is this the right time to get married? And according to what I read, Rav Amital, the Rosh Shiva of Gush, responded that he doesn't think so. He didn't think that this was the right, correct thing during battle, during war, and when there's so much going on. He didn't feel that this was the right time and they should wait till the war is over. And however, he saw that they were not so happy with this, and he apparently asked the Kala to be, what is your opinion? What do you think? And she said, I think we should get married. So Rav Amital said, oh, if that's what the Kala thinks, then that's what we do. And they got married during the war. That was a very famous story. Now, I remember the story. I don't know how many other stories there are like that during the Yom Kippur War. But I can tell you one thing for sure, that during this war, so many weddings occurred. So many stories happened. We have very good friends of ours that the Chatan got out, was supposed to get married the week of Simchat Torah right after, and they had to cancel the wedding or postpone the wedding because of the war. And then he was given 24 hours to go out after 2-3 weeks. And within those 24 hours, they made a wedding. They made a chasana, and he went back to the front the next day. He had one night of his wedding, he was out, and then he went back to war. By the way, I will say, and I'm not talking about this today, that there were fascinating discussions, shilas, that did come up regarding Sheva Brachas. That's not our topic, but I'll just mention that Rabbi Usher Weiss gave a shir and wrote about this. I'm not sure if it was because of this what happened, but he wrote about this, specifically about chayalim. They get married and have to go back in the middle of war, they have to go to leave their wedding and go to battle. Can you make Sheva Brachas for a chasan without a kala? Right? That's a shir of itself. And it's a great shir because it really challenges what is the real simcha? Do you need both participants, or is it our simcha? Is it their simcha? Do we need them? Right? You can have a whole shir about the question of what Sheva Brachas is all about. And use this as a case. But I'm not talking about that right now, but I'm talking about whether or not it's correct to get married in the time of war. And I want to start I'm not going to come out tonight with an answer. This is the right answer, but I'm sharing thoughts about this question. I want to start with the fact that the Torah does somehow relate to a married couple during war. Not in the way perhaps that we're talking tonight, but it does discuss and bring up the idea of marriage in wartime. And I'm referring right now, and Rabbi Kelman, I can share a screen, yeah? Yes, thank you. I can. I'm going to share a my source sheet with everyone. I hope you can see it. So the Torah, I apologize, but most of the sources are in Hebrew, but I will translate them as I read them. The Torah teaches us, I'll just go a second, that when you go to war, you're not allowed to be we appoint a Kohen, Meshuach Milchama, we appoint a Kohen who stands before the army and gives a lecture before we enter battle. I just want to mention that Rav Samit, the great commentator Rav Samit, who lives down the road from me here, when he talks about this idea that we appoint a priest, a Kohen, to give a lecture before war. And the Torah teaches us what exactly is mentioned in this famous talk that he gives. Rav Samit mentions how different we are than other armies. While other armies say their goodbyes and farewell to their army forces with bands and cheering. We go the mood that you can imagine. That the Chayalim here, when they go to war from the Torah description, is a very, very, very different type of mood that they go into battle. Amongst other things that the Kohen must repeat in his sermon that he gives over before battle, he mentions that you shall not fear the enemy. We'll get back to that in a few minutes. But he also tells them that they are not allowed. He tells them who is exempt from war. I don't have this right now, and this I'll go back to it in a second. Here it is in the Rambam. The Rambam says that I will translate the Meshuach Milchama, the anointed priest whose job is to give this sermon. He tells the following: Mi Isha Sherbana Bait Chadash, Umi Isha Shemata Kerem, Umi Isha Sheres. Basically, the Kohen repeats the words of the Torah that teach us who is exempt from going to battle. And who are those people? The man who has married a woman and not really lived with her yet. A man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed the fruit of the vineyard. And a man who build a house and not dedicated, not live in the house. These people are exempt from going to war. At that point, as if all the people standing amongst the soldiers that this situation applies to them are exempt from performing in battle, performing and going out to war. The Torah, however, mentions another type of person that's exempt, and that is a person who has been married. A person who's married, fully married, unlike the first situation, has a year. Naki yele beito, says the Torah. Naki yele beito. The law is that he has an entire year in which he is not allowed to leave his home. And that includes not going to battle. What's fascinating is that the Rambam explicitly limits this law, which is not so clear from the Torah what it's referring to. However, the Rambam tells us all these exemptions are just for what we call Milchemet Reshut, an optional war. In the world of Milchamot, I think we discussed this once before, there are two types of war that Halakha recognizes. One is Milchemet Reshut, an optional war, a war that we don't necessarily have to fight, but yet there are situations in which countries decide, for whatever reason, it's their interest, maybe for economic interests, they would like to invade another country. I'm sure it's not a shock to anyone that there were times in the history of the world that people went out to war because they wanted oil and who knows what else from other countries. It was for gain, for money, for materialism. And those kind of wars we would call optional. The person who would respond, who would go after such a war, it was called Mechemet Reshut. However, the Torah also understands that there's another model called Mechemet Mitzvah. When the mitzvah is performed in battle, then that is a different type of war. What kind of mitzvah? The Rambam explains protecting the Jewish people is a mitzvah. Killing Amalek is a mitzvah. The Ramban understands that this includes any war for the land of Israel is a mitzvah. So there are two types of war. So what's the difference? Okay, two types of war. Mitzvah, great. What does it make a difference? Ah, it makes huge differences. What type of war? There are certain rules that apply to both and certain that only apply to one. For example, the Torah teaches us that when you go out to war, you must begin any war with a call for peace, a call for surrender. The Rambam understood that this is in every type of war. Rashi disagrees. Rashi says the call for peace is only for Mechemet Reshut, for an optional war. But Mechemet Mitzvah, says Rashi, there are no warnings. There are no suggestions of surrender. So we have a Machloket Rishonim. If the call for surrender and peace is in all types of war. However, for our discussion, the Rambam teaches us all these exceptions that the Torah talks about a person who is married, a person who builds a vineyard. All these people are only exempt from a Milchemet Reshut. But Milchemet Mitzvah, and I highlighted here, about the Milchemet Mitzvah, Hakol Yotzin, Afilu chatan michedro, v'kala michupata. In the Mechemet Mitzvah, says the Rambam, all go to war. Even a chatan from his room and a kala from her chuppah. This, by the way, is a Mishnah, Masechet Sota. The Rambam did not make this up. It's a Mishnah, almost word for word, that the Rambam is quoting. Where does the Mishnah that the Rambam quotes get this idea that the chatan and the kala leave their house? So it's a pasuk in Yoel. It's a pasuk in Yoel when in Sefer Yoel, in Trei Asar, the Navi talks about fast days that they are called to make because of the terrible plague that hit the people. And he says, Isfu am, gather the people. Kadshu kahal kinsuz kenim, isfu lim. Gather every type of person to come because we are in troubled times. And everyone, he mentions kahal, the community. This kenim, the elders. Olalim, the babies. Yonkei shadayim, even the babies who are still suckling on their mother's milk. And even yetzeh chatan michedro v'kala, as if the epitome, the highest level of showing how the times that we're living in are so troubled, we call everyone, even the kala and the chatan. So this expression that is mentioned in Tanakh is used by the Mishnah in Sota to describe that at times of war, everyone must go to war. There are no exemptions. Even we break up a wedding, the chatan and kala, they leave the wedding. Now, before we continue, a side remark here, which is really not my topic tonight, but I have to say something about it. The pshat of this pasuk used in the Mishnah, the pshat of the Rambam using this phrase would indicate that men and women are both chayav to fight in war. The pshat language of the Rambam is that there is no differentiation in a Mechemet Mitzvah between men and women, and all are obligated to go out to the battlefield. Now, the truth is, it makes so much sense because, in today's world, we train people. So it's really hard to say, okay, everyone go with your pitchforks out to war, right? But in biblical times, that's literally what it meant. When the enemy is on the gates, everyone must take whatever weapon they have in their hand. and go and fight the enemy. And by the way, that's exactly what happened in the 48 war. The 48 war is a war where men and women fought from all ages. There were children that were fighting. The youngest child to be killed in the Israeli, recognized by Tzal in the 48 war with a 10-year-old child. A 10-year-old child was recognized as an Israeli soldier during the 48 war, and there were plenty of women. I would like to point out that if you ever look at the Kuzari, the famous Kuzari that's translated by Yehuda Evan Shmuel, is dedicated to his son Shmuel and his son's fiance Zohara, who was killed, who was the first Israeli pilot, who was killed in the 48 war. She was killed in battle or in an accident during the 48 war. The famous Kuzari that everyone has in their house, the white one that used to be the famous Kuzari, is dedicated this young man and young woman who were both killed in the 48 war. So that's clear what the pasuk is referring to in the context of that the Rambam quotes. The commentators on the Rambam hesitate and they say, wait a second, does that mean that women have to go to war? How can that be? Women don't fight. So some say, no, it means that women go to war, they don't fight, but they participate in the war efforts. There are such suggestions that are mentioned. However, I just want to mention that this Rambam, this Mishnah, is in a very important quote and source. Yes, thank you very much for bringing that Kuzari. Thank you. Yes, that's exactly the addition. Thank you, Mr. Stein. Yes, yeah, that's it. Correct. You'll see that it's dedicated the Zecher B'ni Yechidi Shmuel Asher. Now, Shmulik, there's a famous play in Israel called Shmulik of Zohara and Shmulik. That was a famous couple that we all as kids read about when we were kids, about this love story about Shmulik and Zohara. And that book is dedicated to Shmulik, the guy who was killed. Okay, so going back a second, this is not our topic. I just said I have to mention this idea because I think it's an important one. But let's go back to this idea. Why is it that the Torah, when it exempts people, it chooses to exempt people who just got married, who have built a vineyard, who have built a house? Why these people? I mean, you know, you could argue that there are other perhaps reasons to exempt people, or not at all. Obviously, as I said, these people are only exempt from Mechemet Reshut. But mitzvah, everyone has to go to war. Before I continue, though, I must make one observation here that's very important. The three people that we mentioned, the person who got married, built a vineyard, and built a house, when they are exempt from Mechemet Reshut, the Rambam says explicitly that they still must help in the war efforts. Even Mechemet Reshut, they don't go home. They have to do war efforts. A person who is married in the first year of marriage, it seems that he and she are exempt entirely from any participation in the army, if even every war effort. So, but again, in Chemet Mitzvah, it would seem that everyone is obligated to engage and be involved. So my question, of course, is why these people? Why Dafka these people? I think the answer is quite obvious to all of us. That the Torah is teaching us here that war is the opposite of building a home. There's eight milchama, eight shalom, eight livnot, eight laharos, says Kohelet. There's a time for everything. Eight milchama is not the time in which we produce, create, build. And all what we just mentioned is about building a home, building a house, literally building a house physically, and building, of course, a house in the sense of a marriage coming together. And I think by the Torah focusing, dedicating the speech of the Kohen to focus on those people, it's giving over the message that war is not a time to think about family, about having a wedding, about starting something. It's a time when the opposite is required. That's one point that I wish to bring up as a, again, I don't have an answer to my question. It's a thought I'm sharing with everyone. The Mefarshim on these psukim argue, what is the reason really that these people are exempt? What are we afraid of? And I noticed that some focus on the fear of what the death of these specific people would do on the people, meaning not the soldiers. Some argue that it's a problem because the soldier themselves, that a soldier just got married and he goes to battle, he's very nervous, he's very scared, he's very down, he's not, he's supposed to get married, now he's at war, this shouldn't be happening to him. And this creates fear by him that can spread to others. So it could be that the focus is really about the army, the soldiers. However, some suggest that it's really more about the people that see this guy being killed, right? If a guy who just got married is killed, how does that affect the morale of the entire nation, of the strength of the people? Now, I want to say that when I read these commentators, it really struck a discussion that I had during the war with a friend of mine. I don't, again, this is just a thought. We were discussing whether or not it's the right thing for the Israeli army to draft older men who have fathers or families, or to draft younger men who don't even have the opportunity. Some said, listen, at least the guy who had four or five kids and was killed in battle, got married, had kids, has something to continue him. The guy who's 21, who doesn't have anything left after his death, no family, on the other hand, when we see fathers, I mean, there's no, these are just thoughts. And I said to you before, there's no right answer here. They both are terrible. They both are tragic. I wonder, I'm asking out loud, how do these affect the morale of people? What creates more a sense of tragedy and a self of helplessness when we hear of young men being killed if they're 21 or if they're 45? As in the beginning of the war, there were a few people, quite a few people in their 40s that are volunteering to do Miluim, to do the reserves, and I don't know. I'm just questioning. The army has certain rules. Who is allowed to volunteer? Who's not to volunteer? For example, if someone has a relative, a son or a brother or a father that was killed in battle in the war, so they are exempt from going to war. They're allowed to volunteer, but they are exempt. So what? Why is that? I think the answer is very simple. Just like we said before, the Torah has its list. But we, the army, Israeli army, has it, today has this list because really, the blow to the family and what it means to lose two people, of course, is even more difficult to comprehend to live with. So these ideas, I think, are really about affecting the morale either of the nation or specifically about the soldiers themselves. So one therefore suggestion that I'm bringing up is that perhaps it could be that the fact that the Torah focuses mostly on people who are getting married, building homes, as the type of person who is exempt from war might serve as some indication that this is really not the time to get war cause, to get married because it's the opposite of what we're trying to do. I would like to suggest another thought about this question. The Rambam, before the Rambam, I have in front of me here. I'll show you those who can see me right now. I'm holding a book that came out after the Lebanon War in 1982 that has there a picture of a postcard of a soldier called Ram Mizrahi, Hashem Yikom Damo. He was a soldier. He was a young man who learned in Yeshivat Har Tzion in Gush. I actually, as a kid, remember him vaguely, and he was killed in the first Lebanon War. And after he was killed, a postcard appeared in the, believe it or not, the postcard that he wrote took a few days to arrive, and his parents received the postcard after he was killed. And in this postcard, he writes very shortly, he says, I don't have much time. It's Erev Shabbos now. He says, but please remember, like I do, that the Rambam says that our battle is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name, Yichud Hashem. And we hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will provide the pasuk Hashem Yilachem Lachem V'atem Tachrishun Anachnu Nitchazek Be'ezrat Hashem Be'ad Arei Elokeinu Be'ad Ameinu. And he quotes this Rambam, that the Rambam in Hilchot Melachim tells us that a person that goes to battle must show no fear in battle. And then the Rambam says something quite amazing, because it seems that the Rambam is almost making this idea up himself. The Rambam says, and I will go back to my source sheet, the Rambam teaches us that, again, going back to the sermon of the Kohen, he must tell the people, and I'm reading it here in Hebrew, once you go into battle, Yeda sha'al yichud Hashem osem milchama, v'lo yira v'lo yifached, you shall not fear the enemy. V'lo yachshov, lo be'ishto, v'lo bevanav, ele yimche zichronam milibo, v'yifne mikol davar lamilchama. The Rambam says, you're not allowed to think about your wife. You're not allowed to think about your children. You must erase as if their existence, and you must focus on the battle, on war. And now look at this. He says, Kol ha-nilcham b'chol libo, b'lo pachad. If you fight without fear, and your whole intention is l'kadesh et Hashem bilvad, you are promised that nothing will happen to you. V'ivnelo bayit nachon b'Yisrael. V'yizkelo ulevanav adolam, v'yizke l'chayei olam haba. A very powerful Rambam. The Rambam says that you, on one hand, you mustn't think about your family, and the reward is, if you fight the battle, that fear is that you will be zoche to build a bayit. Where did Rambam get this idea from? Where did he get this idea? Is it not, again, I'm suggesting that the Rambam got this from where we are taking our ideas from, that the Rambam understands that battle, that war, is not a time for family, is not a time for marriage, is not a time to think about that. Some commentaries mention that this Rambam perhaps comes from a famous Gemara, which I want to discuss. The Gemara teaches us that in the days of David HaMelech, when the soldiers used to go out to war, they would write a get, some kind of conditional get, that if they would not come back from war, their wives would be automatically divorced. And the Gemara in Masechet Ketubot teaches us that was the normal procedure for the soldiers of Beit David. Some suggest that the Rambam perhaps got his idea from this, that if you think about what we just said now, then in Jewish law, in the traditional Jewish law, if that's really true that it was done, that means that every soldier that went to battle was as if not married. I'll explain what I mean. There are throughout the generations, much have been discussed and written about this Gemara. What exactly does it mean? Does it mean that they actually divorced their wives, or they made a condition that if they don't come back, she would be divorced from the moment that they left to war? I'm not going to go into this discussion. It's a topic of itself, what it means. But nevertheless, whatever way you understand this, there is for sure, in a philosophical kind of sense, the idea of this would be that when a person goes to war, he breaks off his ties with his wife, with his family. Perhaps the Rambam got derived some kind of inspiration to what he said from this idea of the Gemara. I will tell you that Rav Meidan, the Rosh Yeshiva of Gush, and I heard this from someone who heard it from him, so I didn't hear it directly. I heard that once Rav Meidan gave a shir about this, and he said that he's not so sure if he agrees with this Rambam. He said, I once asked my good friend, this guy named Schwartz, who fought in the Yom Kippur War and was hurt very badly in the tank. He was burned very badly. And I asked my friend, when you were burning in that tank, tell me, did you follow the Rambam or not? And he said, are you joking? All I thought was about my wife and children when I was in that tank. And Rav Meidan got up in shir and said, okay, machloket Rambam and Schwartz. I think halacha is like Schwartz. Right? That's what I heard that Rav Meidan said. Meaning that it's not, can you, to demand from a person as if to not think about his family is not necessarily a positive thing. Perhaps nowadays, that would give us more strength, perhaps, than not doing so. It's a question of what gives us the strength, as if to disconnect or to connect. I'm sure if I'd open the floor to, you know, to people's thought, we would hear a lot of different opinions about this. I'm just suggesting that it's not so simple. However, again, one can derive from this idea of this get that was given, whether and that this indicates that army, war specifically, is the antithesis of building a family. By the way, I'll just say that throughout the 75 years here in Israel, every war, almost every war, the rabbis have discussed whether or not they should introduce this mechanism and have every Israeli soldier give his wife a conditional get, or at least a what we call the Ketav Harsha'a. Ketav Harsha'a would mean, this is what most people think, is that before a chayal goes to battle, he should sign a document which says that if he doesn't come back, he hereby appoints someone on his behalf to give his wife a get. Now, why would that, what's the advantage of doing such a thing? The advantage, of course, is to prevent agunot, to prevent situations in which, if we don't hear or find out where the soldier is, his wife will not stay in aguna, because de facto she'll be divorced. I'll tell you something fascinating, and I'll go back to my source sheet. Again, Mush had written about this. I'll just mention before I show you the story sheet that right in the beginning of the war, when it was very obvious to all of us that there were plenty, unfortunately, of people that went missing, and we've never had so many people that went missing as we did during this October, this year, that we don't know exactly what happened to them. And the first brigade of the war, there were people that were writing, that's the good and the bad of social media. People were everyone was like writing their opinion, right? Social media it allows everyone to voice their opinion. And I saw that people were writing, oh, well, we hereby encourage every soldier to sign this thing in order, especially women organizations that were very strongly involved in preventing agunot. We're suggesting that Chayalei Tzal should all, sign this. So one of the women that, the friend of mine that was on it, I privately messaged her. I said to her, please, please remove this, because this is not a personal, private kind of matter, in my opinion, at least, that should be discussed. It's really a very difficult and delicate matter that many of the great rabbis during the 75 years of Israel's existence, many of them were very much against this, because they felt that if we were to obligate every Israeli soldier to sign such a document, it will be a big blow for morale. This could be argued, and this is an open argument. I just don't think it should be done on social media. I don't think it should be done during a war. It should be done when we're at calm times, and we can think clearly and make a policy. Perhaps the policy would be correct. And by the way, there are rabbis, and I hear what they say, that perhaps it should be just the same way every Israeli soldier is, you know, we don't ask an Israeli soldier before battle, we give an order. So perhaps we should give an order. I'm not going to go into this question because that might create a get, which is me'useh, which is forced get, which I don't want to go to the whole discussion. But I'm just saying that this is a very interesting question. I will share with you here that Rav Goren himself, Rav Goren, who is the chief rabbi of Israel, discusses this. I will tell you that there were times in the Israeli army that there were actually Israeli army documents that were printed by the Israeli army which were for the purpose of having Israeli soldiers before battle sign that they will give a get to their wives if they don't come back. So there was such an idea. However, Rav Goren, and I have it here in Hebrew. I'll just read to you quickly. He says, "Bevoenu lachtim et hachayalim," when we came to make these soldiers sign the tofes, this document, kama hitnagdut, there was a lot of people that were against this. Mitzad mefakdim, the officers and the chayalim, they said that the mefakdim were saying having the Israeli soldiers sign on a document before he's going to battle, just before going to battle, yifga kashot b'moral halichima shel klal chayalim v'yagbir et hapachad v'et hadaga l'mishpachto. So Rav Goren actually argued against this minhag, that he felt that it was not a positive thing that would create that he would really create some kind of some kind of the word pgiya in morale. This would really hurt the efforts of the morale of Israeli soldiers, and therefore he thought that you shouldn't be doing it. Like I said, this was argued of Herzog, did do it as chief rabbi of Israel, and it went back and forth. Till today, it's a discussion. I know of soldiers that personally, privately did this during this war. And I'm not judging anyone, right or wrong. Who am I to even suggest a judgment? I'm just saying that it's a very, very difficult and not clear I don't have a, personally, I don't have a black and white answer what should be done. I think that this is something really for poskim that have a lot of sensitivity to and have their pulse. You know, they feel the pulse of the people. They're the ones who should really be making this decision. Hopefully, the Israeli army, that's really the rabbinate, should be the one making these decisions. However, as I said to you before, this is also, I think, an indication that war and family life don't go together. And finally, my last source, which I think could serve as a source for this question, would be a Gemara Masechet Ta'anit. The Gemara Masechet Ta'anit discusses, I think, a question that everyone has thought of in some way. The Gemara basically asks, those who don't fight anymore, those who don't are not participating, what should we do in times of great disaster, of terrible times? How should disasters affect my routine, my regular life? Now, I will say this, I'm not going to this right now, but the Gemara does specifically talk about whether or not relationships between men and women, intimate relations between husband and wife, are permitted during famine. That's what the Gemara is really about. The Gemara talks about, that's the question that the Gemara talks about. During famine, is it permitted or prohibited for a husband and wife to have relations, an intimate relationship? And the Gemara learns from Yosef. It says that Yosef had his children beterem tavosh not ra'av, that Yosef had Menashe and Ephraim before the great famine of Egypt. From here, the Gemara proves that during the famine, he didn't have children. Why? Because during famine, you shouldn't have children. And the Gemara brings another source. The Gemara brings a source that when Moshe Rabbeinu was leading the people in the war against Amalek, even though Moshe wasn't fighting, as we know, he had his hands up towards the heaven, and his hands were getting very heavy, so they put rocks under his arms to help, you know, to help his hands stay up. And the question is, why rocks? Why not pillows? Make it a bit more comfortable for Moshe Rabbeinu. And the understanding is that Moshe Rabbeinu cannot understand Imo Anochi Betzarah in the sense we have to participate with with what's going through the people. We can't allow ourselves to be pampered right now when there are people in front of us fighting. Putting pillows would be too much of a pamper. We have to feel the suffering as if of the people. And the Gemara brings this as an example of perhaps how a person should participate at times of great peril, at times of great disaster, how a person should feel the pain of his people and participate in them. Which brought up a halachic question: is this only about famine, or does it, is this true about other situations? The Tzitz Eliezer of Leslie Waldenberg has a tshuva about the Yom Kippur War. People asked him during the Yom Kippur War, is it incorrect or correct for a man and wife to have relations, intimate relations, during the time of war? Now, I want to tell you that I remember when the war broke out here in Israel, the first few days, I saw one of my friend of mine post it. Again, I think it's a bit ridiculous, these posts on these matters and social media. That's another discussion. Rav Jay, that's another talk for another time about, you know, what should we discuss. And but he posted, no one should have relations with their wives till every prisoner comes back. You know, it was like a very kind of emotional thing, which at the time no one knew, you know, where we're going with this. But he uses Gemara to suggest that really life can't go on. Those are fighting, but those are not fighting. You know, and I imagine every one of us that's in this shir right now debated, right? Should I go to a restaurant right now? Should I go see a movie now? I have a vacation, you know, that I planned for the week after Simchat Torah. Should I cancel it? Can I go to Disneyland right now? I mean, I'm sure everyone, and there's really no clear answer to this, because the Rama, even though the Rama in Shulchan Aruch, and I'll bring this to you, I'll read it to you here. The Rama in Shulchan Aruch relates this question, and Paskins, here, I'll give it to you here. The Rama here says, the Shulchan Aruch says, Asul l'shamesh mitato b'shnei re'avon, the years of famine, you're not allowed to have relations with your wife, unless you don't have children. And the Rama says, ve'hu adin b'shar tzarot. The Rama says, even in other troubled times, this applies. But he adds another word, shehem kireh avon, that they are like famine. The question is, what does the Rama mean? So many poskim agree that this is only times of plague and famine, but not in wartime. And the Tzitz Eliezer actually concludes, after a very long discussion, which I'm not going to go into right now, he says that there is no isur, there's no prohibition during wartime. And he says it's even not even a good chumrah, especially not by young people. The I don't want to add anymore. So the Tzitz Eliezer, when the great post came, really said there is no reason to apply this during war. But again, I go back to my question, which I think we can sense from this discussion. The fact that this is brought up is because really it seems to be almost the opposite of war is about. Okay, so I gave here three different areas of discussion in Chazal and Gemaras that perhaps can serve as sources to debate whether or not they can serve as a source for our question. Source number one was the fact that the Torah exempts people who get married and build homes from fighting. Source number two was the idea of giving a get before going to battle. And the Rambam, therefore, based upon that, that one is not allowed to think about his family during war. And the third source was the Gemara that discusses during famine or other troubles that people should perhaps not live a regular, normal way of family life during that time. These three sources would obviously lead us to perhaps argue that it's not the time to get married. However, and now I want to flip everything on the others. I remember during one of the most terrible times that I remember in my lifetime, during the Second Intifada, in the early 2000s, which I'm sure everyone here remembers, those terrible, terrible days in which every other day there was these terrible, terrible attacks, buses blowing up, restaurants blowing up. It was a really terrible times for the Jewish people. I remember there was a story about a young woman who was supposed to get married. And the day of her wedding, there was a suicide bomber that blew up in a bus, or I'm not sure exactly the details, and they couldn't find her brother. They lost contact with her brother, and no one knew where he was. And the time of wedding came, and they still couldn't find the brother, and there was a serious concern that he was a victim of this bombing. And they waited and waited and waited. And at 12 o'clock at night, they confirmed that he was one of the dead. And the story was that at 12 o'clock at night, they made a chuppah. And the rabbi said, we don't postpone weddings. And they made a wedding. I'm sure you all remember the famous, infamous story of Nava Applebaum, who was killed the day of her wedding. Hours before her own wedding, she and her father, Rabbi Dr. Applebaum, were killed in a terrible bombing attack on Rehov Emek Rifaim in Yerushalayim in Hillel Cafe, the day of her wedding. I remember that on the way to my friend's wedding in the year 1996, I remember on the way to my friend's wedding, we heard about a suicide bomber that day, that we found out that a kid from our class was killed on the bus. And he was supposed to be buried that afternoon, that evening. And the family agreed to postpone the Leviathan till after our friend's wedding, meaning there were two kids in the same class. One was getting married and one was being buried. And it was supposed to be the same hour. And the whole class had a dilemma where to go, right? You go to the Leviathan, you go to the wedding, and the family postponed it. So this idea is not a new idea, unfortunately. Shulchan Aruch talks about Lo Aleinu, a situation in which a person dies the day of a relative dies of the wedding. What do we do? The Gemara talks about the idea of what overrides when a chatan and a kala is walking down the street and a funeral is coming towards her. Chazal talk about who overrides what. These debates, these dilemmas are not new, unfortunately, in Jewish history. And I think that one could argue that, unlike what I said until now, that perhaps the reason would be to postpone, to wait with a wedding, there is a lot of reason for us to do the opposite. There is a lot of reason to argue we don't postpone weddings, and this will give the strength to the Jewish people. And this is our answer to our enemies, to ourselves. It could be that the same reasons that perhaps we thought of why during war we shouldn't get married, perhaps nowadays would be the exact opposite reason, that this strengthens the morale of the people when they see the Am Yisrael Chai, and that we continue to grow and to build homes. During October 7th, our enemies literally burned homes. They burned families. They destroyed families. Perhaps in the subconscious of our people, of our young men and women, the feeling was that this is the best response to these atrocities. The way Am Yisrael has two areas in which we respond to these situations. One is we fight our enemies, but at the same time, Am Yisrael Chai, we build the next generation. We build from the ashes. That is our response to all what has happened. And this perhaps is some kind of answer that's not irrational. It's just an answer that happened. This was the answer given by Chayalim and Chayalot of Tzal. Almost like what Rav Mital said, that let's ask the Chassan. I don't care about as if what the sources are. What is the feeling of the chayalim, the chayalot? If they feel that this is the correct thing to do right now, then that might be the correct thing. That is the correct response. And I remember, and I think you all remember, that how much strength it gave us all to see these young men and women and getting married dafka in these difficult times. And I think, by the way, that we see this pattern in a similar way after the Holocaust too. You know, there were some people, there were many people who after the Holocaust felt, you know, we should never step on German soil. We should never go to Poland. We should never go there. We should avoid anything with them. And then in recent years, some people felt, what do you mean? Our sign of victory is to go there with an Israeli flag, to fly a plane over Auschwitz, to wave an Israeli flag in Germany in the middle of Berlin. That is our response. Am Yisrael Chai. So I'm not judging. There is no right answer. But I feel that the answer is coming from the people, is almost exactly opposite of what I was am suggesting before. The feeling from within the Chayalim and Chayalot of Tzal is we must continue with life. We must get married even during the war. And that to me maybe is a psak halacha, as if to this question, de facto of what's coming out of the Israeli army. So that is that's those are my thoughts. I have unfortunately have more that I planned and prepared, but I guess not. I don't have time because it's almost time to finish here. If someone has a comment or a question, I'm more than happy. I just want to mention that hopefully next week. We will bring up another topic, which is also very unique to this war, the question of leaving the base on and coming back on Shabbat, whether or not that would be a halachic reason to mechalel Shabbos during wartime is a very interesting question that came up specifically during this war, and that's hopefully will be our last year in this series of the whatever Gaza war or whatever you want to call it right now. I don't know the name that we're giving it.
Reform to the Gaza war. Yeah. It just hit me. Next week, we are going to be an hour closer to you guys because we changed the clock Saturday night. So I really should probably. So can you make the shiur an hour earlier on your end? Like 1 o'clock Eastern, 7 p.m. in Israel.
Better gamor.
Okay. So we'll keep it. I know I live here, so we keep it sort of Eastern time if that works. Okay, so just if anybody's in Israel, it'll be an hour earlier next week. For those who live here, it'll be the same time. And I think we're till the end of the month, until you guys change the clock. But we'll be...
Thank you for... Okay.
Okay, yeah. All right, any comments there or anybody you want to unmute themselves and say anything? Okay, yeah. Just the one comment here in the chat, Yoel, that the Sefer Rebbe was Yoel Teitelbaum. Okay. Yes. Whatever you want to make of that, you can make of that. You know?
Yeah, so, I saw that. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, if not, then tonight Leah Sarna will be giving the Parsha Shir tonight at 8:30. Everybody is welcome. Invite your friends. And tomorrow I'll give the Siddur Shir at 9:15, and then this Sunday 11th Rabbi Liebtag. Next Sunday. We haven't sent out an email yet, but giving you advance notice. Next Sunday, please God, we'll be having another one of our Yemei Iyun on Purim, like we did for Rosh Hashanah and Hanukkah and Christmas. Lavdil. And last week, but there's a lot to discuss, you know. And so please God, next Sunday, the 17th of March, we'll have before Purim, have a little bit of a Yemei Iyun. We'll send out the details. Okay. Otherwise, we wish everybody well. Hope to see you soon. Please invite a friend to join, and we should be well here. Good news, Besorot Tovot. All the best. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. Erev Tov. Leitrot.
Thank you very much.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Yeah, okay.